Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast series brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. My name is Saiduddin Faridi. I'm a research analyst here, and I will be your host for today's episode on climate and environment in Indian elections. India is in the midst of heat waves as well as the national election, and in some ways, this captures the essence of today's conversation. It is widely known that India is amongst the most vulnerable countries in the world to climate change, and extreme weather events have become increasingly common. A Center for Science and Environment report stated that India experienced extreme weather events almost every day in the first 9 months of the last year. These naturally have significant impact on lives and livelihoods. The Glacier Lake outburst in Sikkim, for instance, led to the loss of over 90 lives, with tens of thousands displaced, and also the destruction of the Teesta III hydropower dam. Similarly, heat waves and cold waves have become more persistent and also led to casualties in the thousands each year. This raises questions around how climate change, a phenomena which aggravates these weather events, is treated in India's political discourse. And we want to use the backdrop of the national elections to answer some of these questions. Are we seeing any changes? Is climate change moving beyond the periphery of electoral interests? And to help us answer these questions, we are glad to be joined by Dr. Navroz Dubash, Senior Fellow at Sustainable Futures Collaborative in New Delhi, and Adjunct Senior Research Fellow at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at NUS. Dr. Dubash, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Saeed. I'm happy to be here.
So throughout the last year, India has witnessed extreme weather events and persistent climate-related issues. Like I briefly mentioned in my introduction, these have been intensifying over the last several years. How do you see political parties responding to these developments? And if we look at the national elections, how have political parties incorporated these themes of climate change and environmental sustainability within their manifestos or within their campaigns for the 2024 national elections?
Right. So thanks for the question, Saeed. So I think I'm going to answer this in two ways. I mean, first, I want to just sort of dwell a little bit more on the impact side before getting into, in a sense, whether or not we've seen a response in the manifestos and in other actions by political parties. You spelt out several impacts, and in fact, the regular drum roll of impacts is indeed alarming. And beyond the, and in addition to the multiple impacts that you're talking about, the sort of extent to which they're disrupting social and economic life is worth sort of commenting on. So, you know, Bangalore being brought to its knees really by floods. We saw July flooding in Delhi. I think it was last year. We've seen multiple health impacts from heat stroke in UP. There are cascading sort of economic effects where India has had wheat and rice bans because we're worried about with lower yields, we want to make sure there's enough food. So that sort of rippling food for our population, so rippling effect in terms of food security. So it's not just sort of discrete impacts, it's straining systems. It's straining entire systems. Now, one can ask the question, how do we know this is entirely climate change, entirely one thing? But it's important for your listeners to know that there is also a nascent science called attribution studies, which actually look at how much of a particular event can be attributed to climate change. And those attribution studies are increasingly showing the climate signal on these impacts is quite strong. So there is something really, in a sense, for politics to respond to. So what has actually happened? What has the response been? Well, I think the good news is that all the parties, and I in preparation for this, I looked at the BJP manifesto. I looked at the Congress, the Indian National Congress manifesto. A colleague of mine also looked quickly at the CPI manifesto and shared some insights with me. And the good news is it's on the agenda. It's on the table. The word is there. It's recognized, and it's often bundled together with environment. But I would have to say that in terms of the directness, as well as in terms of the level of urgency, it's still relatively muted, right? Now, I'll come back to why I don't think that's necessarily a problem. And in a sense that the parties, we have to trust political parties have very acute antennae about these things. And the fact that they don't trumpet climate change, qua climate change, may not be such an issue. But let me get back to that in a second. How do they talk about it? So they talk about it through their other political agendas, right? So the BJP, for example, is linking climate change to its Lifestyles for Environment initiative, which is very much sort of a culturally wrapped up effort to talk about how Indians are inherently more sustainable and can be made to have and adopt lifestyle practices that are also sustainable. It's tied to electricity and India's electricity pledges, electricity generation pledges. We've pledged to increase our capacity of electricity from renewable energy and so on. So that's very explicit. The Congress talks about it really in the language of sustainable development and environmental protection. In all the manifestos, the renewable energy section is the most detailed. So if you looked at this, you'd think that climate change equals renewable energy for India, which is sadly not entirely true. It's to be celebrated that renewable energy is a big deal now in India, but it's not the whole story. And perhaps unsurprisingly, there's relatively little on coal, nothing at all in the BJP manifesto. The Congress manifesto actually talks about expanding the share of mining, all mining, not just coal, but it certainly isn't talking about reductions. Very little on governance of climate change, which is a complex issue. On adaptation, which is increasingly sort of rising up the political agenda, fairly mild stuff around, green spaces and parks and the BJP allocating more money to the National Adaptation Fund in Congress. So it's relatively muted. Now, let me just come back to why I think it's obviously you'd like to see more, but this is the central point I want to get across in the podcast, right? Which is that in India, climate change understood as climate change is unlikely to rise to the political agenda. But climate change understood as the sum of its implications for people's lifestyle and economic choices. What does it mean for farmers? What does it mean for city dwellers and their flooding? What does it mean for the price and access to electricity? Understood as those things, it's much more likely to get political salience. And so if we believe politics is the art of the possible, we shouldn't be so worried if people frame it as an existential threat and give it the label of climate change. We should be more concerned about whether they are pushing their political parties to take actions on things that have the effect of addressing climate change, both in terms of reduced emissions as well as in terms of being more resilient and adapting better. Whether or not it's labeled climate change, if it's smuggled into conversations on electricity and agriculture and coasts, I personally have no problem with it. So that's actually the question really to be asking.
I think that you highlight a very important takeaway in terms of how we think of climate change as a clear-cut category, but it might not always translate as that. And I think that kind of flows into my next question as well, where we do see that there is increasing awareness of climate change among Indian voters, and several surveys do kind of indicate towards that. But how do you see climate change and sustainability feature into their demands or political behaviors?
I think the best way to think about this is to bridge it back to my response to the first question. And actually, there aren't that many surveys. There are really only a couple, and in particular, this Yale Communication Survey gets cited a lot. And that's an interesting one because if you unpack that a little bit, right, it actually says that if you ask about climate change per se, 50% plus, I think it's 54% or thereabouts, of the respondents say they know nothing or little about climate change. But when they're given a description of what climate change is all about, that number that says they know and understand climate change rises to 80% plus. Right? So it underpins this point that The Indian population cares about climate change when they view it through their lived experience. They care about it less as an abstraction. And frankly, you and I would too if we were worried about livelihood needs at the edge of poverty, if we're worried about commuting long distances in urban areas with insufficient public transport. Those are the things, or our children getting sick through waterborne diseases. Those are the things that in the short run would concern us more, right? So when climate change amplifies those effects or operates in a way that sort of coincide with those effects, we will care more. And so I think in India, the politics of climate change is a politics around looking for synergies with between development and climate outcomes and avoiding the kinds of negative trade-offs between them. So it's really about how these things interweave with each other, right? That's I think what the whether the politics is. And so if you look at political activism and what Indians say in surveys around sort of protests and demands for stronger pledges to the Paris Agreement, you're not going to see that much mobilization. You'll see it among a certain segment of the sort of the global the globally engaged Indian population. But if you understand climate action to also be around demands for more secure irrigation, around demands for a more stable electricity supply at a decent price, loan waivers for farmers, avoidance of floods in cities, if you see all of these as proto-climate demands and protests, then the Indian electorate is quite active, right? And I suggest that that's actually a sensible way to look at it. So at the same time, as impacts grow, there is going to be a level of mobilization that is likely to happen around more reaction to climate harms. So some of my colleagues, for example, have studied what many states and cities are now embarked on, which is preparing heat action plans. India's National Disaster Management Authority and the relevant state disaster management authorities are beginning to think about sort of adaptation plans in all these areas in response to particular shocks such as heat waves. So while I think the center of gravity is still going to be, as I said, electricity loans, et cetera, with the Indian state has to also prepare for more effective responses to these shocks that are going to get larger in amplitude and more frequent. So that's kind of a frontier issue, really, as well, when it comes to mobilization by the Indian public.
If we move beyond the Indian state and we look at climate change politics at a subnational level, do you see if states are better equipped to incorporate climate change related issues within the political discourse?
Well, that's a really interesting and important question, and I think that's the new frontier of a lot of thinking is going to be around, what one might loosely call climate federalism, something that my colleague Aditya Pillai has written about quite a bit, sometimes with me and sometimes by himself. The issue is less whether they're better equipped. The issue is that many of the kinds of things that the public will bring attention to are actually issues that are under the jurisdiction of states, or at least states have a partial jurisdiction over, right? So that includes agriculture, urban, which also includes, of course, urban and local bodies, so below the level of the state. Electricity in India's constitution is a concurrent subject, which means both center and states look at it. So in a sense, states, it's less that whether states are better equipped, they have to be better equipped. They have to be the places where a lot of these things are discussed. Now, that said, some states are also indeed getting better equipped in that they're focusing on this in a way. And that is normally in two dimensions. One, which is in a sense the less interesting dimension, states are beginning to take on board the idea that being proactive on climate change is a good way of separating themselves out from the pack, getting donor attention, getting funds, resources, winning reputational gains. And so it's a good thing because it brings their attention to these issues. It's a not entirely good things because sometimes the actions taken are fairly performative. They're just to kind of signal intent, but not a whole lot happens, such as setting up committees and so on and so forth. But that's not the entire story. There are states that are out of a genuine desire to address climate change more proactively, whether it's to position themselves as champions of renewable energy, or to build better resilience for their states, or to address distributional issues, are getting organized around this. Let me give you a couple of examples. So, for example, Kerala has set up something called the Rebuild Kerala Initiative, and this was in a sense provoked by two major floods, and they were able to bring together donor agencies, harness their own money, create cross-governmental structures, and focus both on recovery from those floods, but also importantly on longer-term resilience by putting in place flood management techniques, heat recovery practices, and they also try to integrate this with local government, right? So that sort of fairly thoroughgoing effort. This is now just underway. It's early days. Whether it's successful or not, we have to wait to see, but the intent is clearly there. Tamil Nadu has set up a governing council on climate change and a climate change mission and related missions. Again, early days. I think elements of this are somewhat performative in the sense that it's bringing in some big names on a council. But there's also elements that of it that are quite serious and that are really trying to take seriously both green growth opportunities as well as the need for Tamil Nadu to be more resilient. Bihar is an interesting case because they have actually really focused on just transition aspects, which is to what extent is Bihar going to suffer and deal with and have to deal with the long-term consequences of moving away from mining and in particular coal mining and the impacts that then has on the regional economy. So it's a very specific issue to Bihar and of course a few other states, Jharkhand and others. And they've stepped out on this. So Jharkhand also, if I'm not mistaken, has a just transition commission. Bihar is putting together a net zero plan. So these states are active and they're focusing quite a bit more on the coal transition dimensions of the story. So I think one can look for a lot more state level action in the coming years.
That's quite interesting, and considering how within we see developing countries competing for financing and investments on renewable energy projects, to see states as well within India competing for financing of such projects as well. And if you kind of look beyond states themselves, another important actor within the polity is civil society. And perhaps, how do you see civil society playing a role in public advocacy around climate change and environmental sustainability, given that they have a role in changing public opinions?
So clearly, and we started by talking about political parties. So clearly, the kind of broader conversation around how politics gets shaped and the role of civil society in shaping politics is part and parcel of India's broader political moment right now. And of course, we're in the middle of elections. And the way I see it, civil society has multiple roles. I mean, it has a role to educate and empower people to act as consumers. And so that's a lot of actions around resident welfare associations and what community groups can do in their role as consumers. But equally and not and perhaps more important is to what extent do they mobilize people in their role as citizens. And in that sense, I think we are in a moment right now where explicit demands around climate change as an issue for the reasons I mentioned earlier are less likely to happen. We're not likely to see broad scale Extinction Rebellion sorts of mobilization in India because, as I said, it's much more about lived experience. but we are likely to see and are seeing much more insider technocratic engagement to try and help design policies, to try and inform government on particular opportunities. So you're seeing a lot of think tank engagement going on, and the government is open to that think tank engagement. But that is typically more at the level of technical engagement. I think in terms of the broad framing and narrative, the government really has made it clear and wishes to be in the position of setting those agendas, and it's less about having those agendas be substantively set by civil society action. And it's also become more challenging as the issue has become politically charged to for civil society organizations to play perhaps as big a role as they played in the past on ensuring accountability with certain pledges and promises and so on. So I think there is a role for civil society. It's probably shrunk a bit, and it's more focused on technical engagement. And working with the grain of what the government wants to do, trying to basically ensure implementation happens. So implementation is increasingly the mantra and the watchword. I think it's a good thing. We do have to implement. At the same time, it's partial and incomplete because sometimes governments take wrong policy directions or imperfect policy directions or incomplete policy directions, and it's worth having scope for public discourse and dialogue to see if that can be rounded out and made more complete or steered in more productive directions. So I think having that space for the bigger picture discussions is valuable, and perhaps we've lost a little bit of that in recent years.
Looking at experiences of other states, climate politics has become a critical and mainstream issue in several countries, particularly in the global north. And we see emergence of political parties focusing on climate action and sustainability. The Brazil elections come to mind, where the Amazon forest was a major issue at the time of elections. So what My question, the question I planned to ask you was, what approaches can India take to bring climate change to mainstream politics? But I feel like you've already touched on that in your initial answer. So perhaps I will reframe this and ask you, does India need to mainstream climate change like we've seen in other countries?
Yeah, so I think the answer I would propose to you is a little bit of a middle of the road answer, right? Which is to say that in other countries that you're drawing examples from, they're less unlike India than you would think. So, for example, Brazil's discussion of the Amazon forest and it's always been a part of Brazilian politics. A lot of it was really about. So, for example, when Brazil made a big push to reduce deforestation in Amazonas in the 2005 to 2015 sort of window, a lot of it was actually tied to coming up with arrangements that allowed for alternative economic opportunities aside from deforestation, right? So they actually were able to win political support with local communities by finding other economic opportunities and simultaneously ramping up some of the monitoring mechanisms. And because they had support from the broader population, somewhat reining in the cattle ranchers and others who were behind logging, right? And the way in which that intersected with climate politics in Brazil was that it allowed the government to represent itself internationally as a climate champion. So the point I'm making here is that the same action can be presented in different ways to different audiences, and it comes back to politics being the art of the possible. India did something similar, right? One of its landmark actions, which is the National Solar Mission, which originally led to 20 gigawatts of solar, a very interesting mechanism called a reverse auction, where subsidies were provided, but in a bidding sort of way. So, not open-ended subsidies. Whoever bid for the least subsidy would get it. That was projected internally as an energy security measure and projected externally as a climate measure. So we did the same thing, right? And I think that that's actually the way forward. It's not in any way a negative statement to say that climate measures are packaged as other measures in domestic contexts, right? So other countries do this too. The most extreme example, or the most high-profile example, is the United States in its domestic politics after years of trying to get what is called a cap and trade legislation, where you cap emissions and then you create a trading program, which meant mobilizing US politics around climate change, qua climate change, and failing. Their landmark climate legislation is the Inflation Reduction Act. I repeat, Inflation Reduction Act. Note the absence of the words climate change, right? It is basically an act to promote green technology development and adoption, bundled together with healthcare, and all within a jacket of inflation reduction. Right? They figured out a process and a marketing and a framing that worked in their political system. So you get things done on climate change often by calling it something else, working with it with the grain of local politics. So I actually think that is how more and more countries are going to respond and react. There are a few countries where climate qua climate is has support as an existential issue. Maybe a few Scandinavian and Northern European countries, right? Where your politics and your policy packaging both kind of converge around this kind of existential framing. But in most other countries, including many Western countries, and certainly most of the developing countries, it is more going to be around sort of finding ways of telling, of bringing about climate gains while embedding it within complementary objectives, whether those are jobs, whether that's energy security, whether it's air pollution, which incidentally is what really drove the big changes in China, right? So to my mind, the question is less about elevating climate change qua climate change among competing objectives, and more about strategically hitching climate change to agendas that have big locomotives attached to them, and by drawing the linkages between them more skillfully and more sensibly, right? And none of that will negate talking about climate change both at the global level as well as in India as an emerging issue, but doing it in ways that join the dots to paint a more convincing picture over time, rather than trying to displace one picture with another picture, if that makes sense.
Thank you for that really insightful answer. And I think for delving into how climate policy is contextualized with local politics, I'm sure our listeners will find this conversation very insightful. And with that, we sort of come to our end on this podcast. Thank you so much, Dr. Dubash, for joining us today.
Thank you, Saeed. And thank you, Harpreet, if you're on this call.
You were listening to South Asia Chat. You can learn more about our work by visiting us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates on our research and publications through social media. You can find us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.